I think we like talking about more than just sales and marketing.
We just want to bullshit and chat about business and life. And hopefully, while we're doing that, provide a lot of value to people.
The world's best business podcast.
Oh, shit. We got it.
For people trying to get shit done.
Done. Yeah. We don't want to give you feedback that's bullshit.
Yeah, we want you to do your best.
So to start off with, as I said, we've got a bunch of questions to go through. The first one comes from Ryan Bennick, and he says, after a customer has started a trial, it's our job to help them become successful with our product. This effort will lead to long-term customer with big lifetime value. What suggestions do you have for engaging and nurturing the onboarding process, given that we know what milestones the customer will need to reach in order to become successful?
It depends heavily on who your customer is, what kind of company you run, what kind of culture you have, what you're good or bad at. But in very generic terms, if you're early in the process, I would do anything and everything possible. And I wouldn't worry if it's profitable or scalable. So you might want to drive to their office, you know, and spend an afternoon with them, get to know them, set them up. If you can't do that, you want to definitely call them, you know, talk to them, figure out why did they sign up? How did they find out about you? What are their needs? What are other things they've looked into? Build a relationship and help them succeed with whatever it takes. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you can just go up the different steps of things that scale more, but are less personal, so they lack some context and they will lack some crucial insights. Because the crucial thing here is, whatever it is that you think you know that your new trial users need to do to be successful, you're probably wrong about a bunch of stuff. And the only way to get real insights into what they truly need to be successful, you want to spend as much time as possible trying to get to these insights. And spending time with them in person, on the phone, is going to be a lot more insightful than just sending them a survey or just automating drip emails. But there's thousands of tactics, webinars, drip emails, you know, tons of stuff that you can do to help people onboard. But I would say spend more time trying to understand truly what it takes for somebody to be successful. And don't be that fast in thinking you know what it is. Because you have a bunch of assumptions that are probably wrong.
So it's more about making sure that you go through that learning process. Just because you think something, like say, for example, they need to sign up and set up their account and they need to do X in order to make the product work, for example. Don't just assume that, oh, throwing a video out there is going to do it. Like, you actually have to call them, talk to them, walk them through that and see what it is that kind of motivates them to actually do that.
That's one thing, but you might even be wrong about, you think, well, everybody that sets up their email account on our system will be, you know, more active and more successful. And that might be true, but it might not. Mm-hmm. Right? You really need to make sure that you're not jumping to conclusions too quickly. And also, even once you've figured out what makes somebody really successful in the onboarding process, your job is not done forever. Because people change, businesses change, your product changes, the market changes. So you want to make sure that with some level of frequency, you go and revisit and test your assumptions again and go, we always knew that this is making people successful. Is this still true today?
Right. And that goes kind of back to what I think Des said this morning about having people go through your sign-up process, for example. That's kind of what you're getting at.
I do want to mention one thing before the next question about this that sums up kind of some of it. Is the person that did the concierge onboarding course here somewhere? Because there was a concierge onboarding course. I think it was a Microsoft attendee. But basically, the tactic is called concierge onboarding. And there's a bunch of ebooks and stuff like that out there about it. I think what people jump to is the product sort of marketing and the drip emails. And instead, doing something where you're hand-holding a lot more so you can learn is much smarter. And there's a name for it, concierge onboarding. So look that up. And I think that'll give you an idea of how that sort of process would work.
Very cool. So the next question comes to us from Peter Shanley, and he says, have you seen patterns around third-party service integrations that are an important part of product strategy and when it would be most useful? For example, when are they the most strategic and helpful for acquisition, churn, revenue expansion, et cetera?
I like the last part of it better than the other parts of it because it starts with like what you're trying to improve. So any of those integrations, like usually you're trying to improve a metric. Just as a quick tip, unless it's like a Shopify app store type thing, a lot of the integrations won't help you with acquisition. So you might want to think about these integrations for retention or engagement. For example, if you integrate with Slack with your product, because I know that's becoming a really popular thing, you want to look at doing that if you think that getting that information, data, engagement in Slack would increase your retention or increase your engagement. So I would just say that like it really depends on what the problems are in your business and whether an integration is going to help solve them, and also whether you're trying to attract new customers from it that might not already might if your existing customers didn't need that integration. So again, just back to what's your business problem and how our integration is going to help solve it is the approach I would take.
Are there situations where you can see that those integrations are generally, I guess, predictable as being an ultra good thing for your business? Like, are there certain market verticals that those types of integrations work better for, or is it very, very largely dependent on like the audience that your product serves?
Every single thing I've seen is dependent on audience and also dependent on what's popular right now. Okay. So you're seeing so many Slack integrations. If you see other companies be successful with it or something, really try to figure out why they're being successful, because I actually think the opposite. I think it's risky to integrate without understanding how it's going to impact your user base and your own metrics.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
I think it's one of the themes of the conference so far that I've seen, which is like, you could waste a lot of effort on it and it might not be the one most important thing or the thing you should focus on. So you could spend all this time doing a Slack integration for your finance app when they don't use Slack or they don't want the finance numbers pushed to Slack and stuff like that.
Okay. So our next question comes from Lester Buck. And he says, we can always practice selling by selling our own products and services, but that doubles the tension because it's our product. And we can't be sure whether it's the product or us having no sales skills when we're having troubles. What are some strategies for introverts, techies, and geeks to learn to sell by selling other people's products? One guru once suggested telemarketing for a weekend, but from Craigslist ads, they asked for a year's experience. And during the week, is something like Sandler sales training worth trying?
Hidden.
this is not for me.
This is clearly not directed to me. So there's so much in that question. So let's say you don't have a lot of sales experience. You would classify yourself as a more technical person. And you're like, you know, when we fail selling our product, we don't know, is it the product? Is it me or is it the product, right? And should we go and try doing, you know, telemarketing or taking courses? All that can be great, but the question is just, what is the optimal use of your time? If you had all the time in the world, I would tell you to take all classes, read all the books, do everything, right? But if you already have a product, might as well invest the effort in trying to sell that. If you're uncomfortable about it, what I would tell you to do is, like, sales is something that happens every day. You just have to think about it that way. So instead of selling the product to a customer, maybe what you need to do first is selling people on giving you feedback about their problem, right? How about you're setting the goal every day, I'm gonna have 10 conversations with people. If you don't know where to find people, just go into, you know, a Starbucks or something and buy people coffee and then say, I have 3 questions, and learn to ask good questions and dig really deep and try to understand their issues or their challenges around the problem that you're trying to solve with your product, mm-hmm. right? You can sell so many things. It's yourself asking people for time or feedback and improve and iterate on that without being, a lot of people think to be good at sales, you have to be incredibly charismatic, and you don't at all. Like, you just need to understand how to ask some really good questions to understand what the problem is from the other side, and then indicate it or come to a conclusion if your product solves that, and then tell me that in a succinct way with the next action item. Hey, now that I heard these 10 things about you, I really think the product that I've built can solve your issues. Here's how it's going to do it and why it's good. And here's what I want you to do. You know, put your hand in your pocket, bring out the one with the credit card, and let's get started with a trial. Or something. You have to face that moment of truth of asking for something and then having the rejection as a response where people go, well, I don't want to do that. And that's where most people go, oh, I failed. And if you just stop doing that and you go, oh, now we can learn something. Hey, do you want to sign up for my new free product? Or do you want to sign up for my product? No. Cool. Why? What is missing? Was it me? Like, did I do a bad job? Am I talking too much, too little? Did I ask the wrong questions? Can I buy you coffee and ask you for feedback? I'm trying to improve. I'm trying to do better. What is it? Is the product really not doing what you want it to do? Why? If you think about it more as a learning experience versus a failure or success, I'm good or bad at sales, you're going to improve and get better and better at it. And there's talks out there. And if anybody in the audience or this specific person want to know a lot more, you can just shoot me an email at stella@closeout.com. I'll send you some resources and talks on, like, how to systematically get better at sales if you're not a sales dude or gal. But it's just the way of the attitude and approach is much more important than learning how to do sales or selling for somebody else.
It seems to me like there's an underlying theme with this question about being comfortable doing sales and being comfortable facing that rejection time and time again. And I've heard different strategies to essentially overcome those fears, one of which is you're not trying to make 3 sales, for example, per day. You're trying to just make 10 calls or 15 or 20 or something like that. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because, I mean, it seems to me like it's more of a psychological fear than it is about, you know, actually meeting sales numbers or, you know, getting a certain number of meeting a specific metric that is actually outside of your control. Like, you can control whether you make 10 calls or not, but you can't control whether or not, you know, 3 people actually purchase or anything.
Yeah, I would even take that idea further and go, instead of focusing on, you don't want to focus on success in sales, which is like, let's get 3 closed deals today. You can focus on activity, which is I'm going to make 10 calls. But even a level higher than that is to focus on failure. So to say, you know what, if I make 10 calls on average, 3 are going to be good, which is not going to be the case, but just for easy math. So I'm going to have to be rejected 7 times to get to success. So my goal every day is to get rejected 7 times. So if you get lucky or unlucky and you made 10 calls and you didn't reach anybody, your job is not done, right? And also, if somebody rejects you, that is now something that you can check off a list that is actually a little bit of something that brings you closer to your ultimate goal. So it's a little bit of playing mind games with your own head. But at the end of the day, sales, just like entrepreneurship, is not about being comfortable. That is not the name of the game. Asking somebody, nobody likes rejection. Neither do I. So asking somebody for like, hey, do you want to do this? Do you want to sign up? Do you want to give me money? Is an uncomfortable moment. All you have to do is train that muscle, train to be more comfortable with doing uncomfortable things, because there's no way around it. I have no better way of doing it. So when people, I think that this is a good add-on question, because a lot of times people, because they feel so uncomfortable, they try to avoid that. And then they go, can I read a book that's going to make this easier? Or like, can I watch a talk? Or can I do something else? And you can do all these things, but it's not going to make it more comfortable. You have to get comfortable with the idea that you're going to have to feel a certain level of discomfort consistently if you want to accomplish the dreams and goals you have for your business. So the sooner you get, you know, the sooner you accept that reality, the easier your life's going to be.
Excellent. Great. Our next question comes from Jack Jones, and he says, what are some strategies you've seen work for repairing burnout?
Yeah, I'm assuming this is more like I started the business and I'm burnt out.
Or you've just like overworked. You put in, you know, 50, 80 hours above and beyond maybe what your full time is.
This ends up going into like lots of sort of contextual, like, why are you burned out? Are you not making enough progress? And a whole bunch of areas like that that end up being very personal is kind of what I've noticed. So overall, if you feel burnt out and you've been trying to start your business, it's probably because you haven't been making progress fast enough. And the first thing to do when you feel that burnout is like step back and think to yourself, like, why am I actually burnt out? And is it something that I continuously do that I should stop doing? Is it something that I'm not doing that I need to start doing? So it's just an evaluation of the things you're doing and are they helping you make progress or not? And oftentimes, you know, especially if you're an engineer or even a marketer, you're going to default to doing the things, again, even related to the last question, things that are very comfortable for you, which you can keep doing. Maybe you feel like you can keep doing them. Like, you can keep writing code, but if nobody's coming and using your product, at some point you realize that if I keep writing code, I'm going to run out of money or I'm going to run out of time, right? And so is it burnout because you've been writing all that code, or is it burnout because you haven't been making the progress? So I try to quantify it not necessarily as I'm burnt out because I'm working too hard, or I'm burnt out because I've worked 100 hours a week, because I've seen people working 100 hours a week that would never say they're burnt out. And I've seen people working 100 hours a week that say they're burnt out. And the difference between those two groups is deceptively simple, which is the folks that are working 100 hours a week and are motivated to keep doing that are making progress. And they know that the things they're working on are really important to get what they want. You know, their hopes and dreams, as Steli put it. And if you're sort of working the 100 hours a week and you feel burnt out, there's probably an underlying root cause that's less to do with the 100 hours a week and more to do with progress, more to do with growth, and a lot of other things like that.
So are there specific questions you can ask yourself, or like a framework that somebody could use to try and help pinpoint the specifics of what the underlying cause is?
Yeah, I mean, it's usually because your framework is you might not have one, right? And it's a framework for making sort of progress, which again, deceptively simple. Am I working on the most important thing right now? So if you don't have a product, then you probably need to work on getting a product. Getting a product means finding a problem people have. And it's likely, you know, if you're burnt out and you're an engineer, you've been working too much in the land of making the product instead of figuring out what's important in the product. So, you know, I'll give you the ultimate framework for me on a business, which is there's two things that matter, product and distribution. Everything else is sort of related to one of those two. So anytime I hear someone say they're burnt out, I try to just give them the framework. Well, is it that you have a product and you can't market it? Or is it that you've got all this marketing or all these users or something, and for some reason that product's not working, right? Which might almost sound like the same problem, but if you're burnt out, it's one of those two things that's just not working. And you might be doing the wrong thing. You might be trying to get all these customers and your product sucks. Or you might have, you know, very few customers and you don't know if your product sucks because you don't have enough customers. So the framework I would just give you is step back and think about, where is my problem in my business that's preventing me from making progress and causing me to feel burnt out? You're probably just working on the wrong things.
Excellent. And our next question comes from Kurt Elster, and this is, I believe, specifically aimed at Heaton. So Heaton, you're going to have to answer this one.
So Stelly's going to answer it.
No.
Yeah, I'm going to answer it.
No, you're not going to answer this one.
Stelly's going to answer
Try
it.
Try to no, stop me. What are you going to do?
The goon squad down here will make you.
What are you going to do?
He's okay, Jaden's going to answer it. How about that?
Yeah. All right. How is Stelly's hair so perfect? You sure you want to answer this
That's
one,
Stelly? That's a Stelly answer. I don't look at his hair.
Let's go to the next question.
All right. So I guess at this point, we'll take questions from the audience. I will be wandering around here. Where's the first question? Right here.
Okay, so this is a sales question. Is there a particular time of day that's best to do cold outreach? I ask that because I've got like an outbound, you know, drip campaign, but I've also done, you know, just pick up the phone and call. I have noticed that like on Tuesday afternoon, probably like a little bit after lunch, I get a pretty good response rate when I'm following up with people. Well, that's on follow up. So as far as like outbound, is there a particular good time of day? Does it depend on the industry, et cetera?
It totally depends on who you're trying to reach. Who is that person? What does their life look like? How do they organize their day? So in some cases, it might be very early, even earlier than you think. It might be very late. It might be on the weekend. It might be at odd hours or at times where you would not expect that it's a good time to try to get in touch with somebody. So the only answer there is to experiment. Right? There's the typical things. There's kind of typical truths like Mondays and Fridays, very broadly speaking, are busier days in a corporate setting, so people tend to be potentially less responsive, but breaking that rule can be very profitable if you have the type of customer that doesn't have stressful Mondays or Fridays, or maybe a customer that gets a lot of important calls on Monday, so they are in the habit of picking up the phone when they get a call on Monday. So no, there's no universal truth. You should experiment a lot and then see what gives you an outsized return, and maybe there isn't, but a lot of times there is a day and a time that works better than others. And it's not the same for everybody.
I'm going to give you a quick hack, which is you can, if you have any kind of like analytics on some website where you know it's that audience, because you probably have a website, just go look at the hours, time of day, day of week, and things like that, that people are visiting your website. At least you'll know they're online. Now, that doesn't mean you want to send it when they're doing that. That's more of a judgment call, but it can inform you on what time of day and day of week to test, at least.
Yeah, and adding one little thing to that, if you have a website that people can sign up on or a landing page, something people do that you then try to reach out to them and communicate with them afterwards, trying to call people within 5 minutes of them taking that action online is going to have significant returns on your reach rate, because people are still at their computer, they just looked at your stuff, they're probably not in a meeting or somewhere else, out in the gym or something. So there's even studies about that. The ROI is huge. So if you ever try to call people after they took an inbound action, like signing up for something, test out what the results are if you call them really quickly after they took the action versus calling them an hour or a day later. Next question.
Next question over here.
Thank you, Lee. So I have a question about identifying my market. And I'll give you the context. I'm building a database application builder, and it's been being built for over a decade. I have seen competitors, companies, judging from the number of employees they have, I know they are making revenue, but where I'm getting stuck is who are they selling it to? how are they approaching them? I'm kind of stuck. I don't know where to, you know, can you identify some strategies I could use to identify their my competitors, you know, and customers, and try to do something similar to reach and, you know, talk to people in that space?
Oftentimes, just looking at competitors' businesses or websites, it's very hard to determine how they're getting customers. I think you're hitting this problem, and I've seen it quite a bit. So the approach that you should take is go talk to people that could either use your product, or go talk to people that are using those competitive products, people meaning customers, and actually go figure out how they've discovered the product
and keep on going,
and what they think about it. He's just saying that to me because I get distracted. Sorry. Anyways, everything starts with the customer. So do whatever you can to go have enough conversations with potential customers. And a lot of these questions will start getting sort of, you'll have a lot more clarity. You might not get the definitive answer, but you'll know things like, oh, in this market, people it looks like most of these customers found out about these companies from a conference, or they found out online through some ads, right? But they'll tell you, the customer will actually tell you. So if you're already competitor focused, one of the best things to do is get customer focused by talking to their customers and figuring out who they are, where they are, et cetera, and just trying to get a hold of them. Another option would be it was one thing that kind of was mentioned earlier in the day about sell the situation. So there's probably a situation people are in when they should be using your product. And if you think about it that way and hypothesize that, you can go reach them or try to think up, how can I reach them when they're in this situation? But the biggest piece of advice I can give you is go find customers or potential customers and just go talk to them. And your go-to-market and all those kind of things become a lot more clear.
Totally agree with him. Heaton, you have to like come closer. You're totally in the dark, which I appreciate, and I'm like getting all the light. But some people want...
Is that better?
Yes, much better. And just one add-on. We'd have a longer conversation with you on like why you've built something and you're so focused on the competitors. But just to throw out this hack, because I know salespeople and most people here don't as well, you can always sign up for your competitor's site to get a demo or trial or something. Some salesperson, typically a more junior one, is going to get in touch with you. And that person is going to be more than willing to give you all information you want if you just ask the question. So you go, oh, how many people are you guys? Huh, you know, I found you this way. How are most people finding you? I wonder, what is your ideal customer? So just so I know that I'm the ideal customer. And you just get all the, you will get, if you ask three questions, they'll keep talking for another hour and telling you things you haven't thought about asking. So just as a little hack on top of that.
So you guys are past like 22 minutes at this point. You good? You all right? That's not the...
We're not going to tell you.
Okay.
We see it, but you're not going to know. We're good on time.
We're way good.
So I have another cold calling question. It turns out in Canada, we can't send cold emails anymore. So I'm turning to cold calling, and I'm just wondering if it makes sense to hire a VA to set up my demos for VPs and IT leadership for my B2B product. So my concern is that the resources might not have the subject matter expertise to be able to, you know, engage the technical leadership in order to set up these demos or set up these appointments.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I don't know. The answer is I don't know. You could just try it for a week and then you'd know. But if I had to guess, I would guess that You don't want to outsource something you haven't done and you don't understand yourself well, right? And with sales, it's the same thing as with product development, right? So a lot of times people ask me, hey, Steli, we're ready to start selling, so we're going to... Can you recommend us an outsourced sales firm? Because I was running one. And my answer is, no, I can't recommend anyone. But the answer is like, how can we outsource this sales thing? And I always tell them, have you done sales at all yourselves in any kind of capacity? And the answer is no. It's kind of like me saying, you know what? Heaton, I want to build a social app that's going to be as big as Snapchat. And I need a web development firm. And then Heaton asked me, well, what's the app? What's the idea about it? I'm like, oh, I don't have an idea. I just want to...
Don't hire a firm.
Yeah. I just want... Here's going to be my ask for that web development firm. It needs to be social and mobile. And we want to reach 1 million people. Well, if they knew that, they'd build it themselves, right? It's not that... How good of an idea does that sound to you guys? It's the exact same to my ears when somebody's like, I've never done sales. We know nothing about sales. but we're going to outsource the sales problem. It's hire a PA, but is the question like somebody without domain expertise, can they set up calls? They need to have cold calling expertise, right? They need to be able to talk in a way on a cold call to capture somebody's attention, get their trust, and then get them to buy into the minimum amount of value prop to jump on another call. If they're really well trained on that, they're going to be able to do it without understanding the industry at all. But if they have not done cold calling, they're not really like ninjas on that, then no, it's not as easy as just getting them on the phone. Why at least, you can always try and see if this is a different case, but the chances of success are low.
I'll throw one in, which is why cold calling, but don't answer that. Like, you might want to try alternatives to email and phone.
So I have a question about controlling the success of your marketing. So say you have a product, you want to grow it very slowly. You want to make sure you can provide support. You want to make sure your infrastructure handles it. But you also want to experiment with some wider reach marketing like email campaigns or Google AdWords. How do you kind of compromise controlled growth with starting to look at larger scale marketing?
Yeah. You're basically talking about marketing channels, right? And you have ones that are working. I mean, this is everybody. Like, if you have some scale, it sounds like you do. So you have ones that are working. You have ones you might have tried before that are not going to work for you, or at least you believe that. And then you have this third bucket, which you might not have yet, which is always have some percentage of your resources on marketing dedicated to channel discovery. So it's just experimenting with new channels. So for example, spend $500 on Reddit. The number's actually 5,000 now, you know, on a very high scale on most experiments when you're really trying to find new channels, but you can spend 500 and get a good idea if you want to spend more money on most channels. Although all channels are generally getting expensive when it's paid marketing. But if you're trying to find like organic channels that are not paid, it's the same process. How do I figure out how to spend the least amount of effort to see if this thing's going to work for me? Right? And most marketing boils down to basically get traffic, convert the traffic. So that's a framework there that I would use against all the different channels you have and figure out if you can get traffic from the channel and then figure out, not necessarily in this order, and then figure out if you can convert. Now, there's a lot of ways to figure that out. Like, you go do some analysis. If it's Google AdWords, you do a bunch of analysis on who's advertising and whether you think they're getting traffic based on the keywords they're advertising for. And when you look at their site, are they converting it? And if that looks good, then it's something you might want to try yourself. So there's a lot of different tactics to do the experimentation, but most folks tend to not do that third bucket, which is experimentation. Because otherwise you're never really going to discover kind of what's next. And whatever you're already doing is foundational probably, and it's already getting you some base level of growth. But to get more growth, you probably are going to need more channels.
One thing to add to this, don't worry about future success so much, right? Because that's a worry that a lot of times is wasted. Oh, we would like to do this, but then how are we handling the millions of customers that have come to us? You know, you can always tell people no, you can always stop things, stop running a marketing channel. You can always create like limitation. You know, we're running this marketing thing that's gonna drive millions of people, but we say we only have 10 spots open. Like, you can always do things to limit it, but worrying too much about what to do because if it's too successful, it's gonna be a lot of work, usually is not the best way to spend worry, so.
Stelly, I've heard you speak at another conference about how you partnered with someone at Close.io to help you with the content marketing, all the videos, the blog posts, the ebooks, everything that you've created. I'm really curious about that person that you work with, if that's still the case. Like, is it a marketing person? Is it a writer? I'm in a similar situation. I'd like to find someone to help take what I say to customers and create, you know, some long-lasting, you know, sort of materials like that. I'm curious about that relationship.
So this is somebody that I've been friends with for 15 years. He lived in my apartment for 2 years when I was back in Europe. So, you know, if you know somebody for that amount of time and you've lived with them, maybe you should think about them in a marketing role. So this friend of mine was doing, I mean, this is the exact...
My wife does not want to write down what I say.
Okay, fair. Mine neither. So that's why I looked at friends as an option. So he was doing a lot of marketing, but he had very little experience about SaaS stuff. And we just started working together, and it was a long and slow process. And it took a long time until we found our groove and found like a really good machinery. We have an episode on like how to do scalable content marketing, and I actually like break down the formula on how we do it. But yeah, the basic thing is that the fastest way for me to generate content is to create video. And then we take that video today, it's like our raw material in the content fabrication, and we push it through a process now where multiple people work on this. They'll take the video and they'll turn it into a blog post. We take the blog posts and we turn them into books. We take the books and we turn them into, and we just repurpose and remix a lot. But the raw material at the beginning of it is just video, because that's a medium I can create somewhat of a good quality but very high quantity content.
Let me give a quick tip, because that's what we do, right? If you have the budget, you can just hire people, a lot, like not a lot of them, but like four or five of them, to actually do the thing you want them to do. So it could be that you record a call and you say, I want to turn this into marketing material. Take my call, turn it into marketing material. Give that to four or five people, spend $50 to $250 bucks each, and just keep doing that until you find the people, maybe one, maybe more, that can actually work with you on that. So when you have a task, like you came at it with a deliberate task. I have calls and I want to turn that into something else. So just hire people, and it's really inexpensive. And we've gotten lucky when we take processes like that, where you just take a process and hire multiple people to do it and see who you like.
What time do we have to tell you something about time?
Yeah,
we're good.
So as an engineer, I kind of have an implicit bias against interruption marketing. But I find myself in a situation where I really want to start using cold calling as a technique. And so I've been trying that, but that implicit bias is coming across over the phone in terms of like lack of confidence or lack of confidence in the product. How do you kind of get over that, I guess?
I'm going to start, and then Steli will take over the sales part. I want to point out one thing, though. And this could be just semantics, but I wouldn't consider outbound marketing. I'd consider it purely sales. And the reason is the tactics you use aren't marketing tactics, they're sales tactics, because you're trying to get a conversation. So just want to clarify, in my mind as a marketer, I wouldn't want outbound to be thought of as a marketing thing, although I get why, because it's meant to acquire customers. But it acquires customers straight into the sales process, so you generally need more sales tactics and less marketing tactics.
So, yeah. So first, I think you're identifying a really important point, which is if you're not sold, you can't sell. Right? And this is, I think, an overlooked truth because it's so obvious and so simple. But if you're not really sold on what you do, you're going to struggle selling me on it. But this translates to many parts of the sales cycle. If you are incredibly cheap in the way you make buying decisions, you're probably going to struggle selling a high premium product, right? If you, like, whatever you're trying to get other people to do, ask yourself, when was the last time I did this, right? When was the last time I signed up for a trial with my credit card before even looking at the product? When was the last time I did whatever I'm asking other people to do? If you're like in the, this is the way the world works and this is the way I act, you're gonna be authentic, and that's gonna translate into you assuming that the other person is gonna agree with you versus what you're doing, which is you're assuming I'm gonna annoy this person, I'm gonna interrupt their day, I'm gonna destroy their productivity, potentially their life. This call is gonna make the world a worse place. All right, there you go. Let me make the next call, right? If that's the foundationally the way you think about this, this is gonna be really hard, right? This is gonna be harder than it needs to be. So, I mean, in this specific case, I'd have to ask you a million questions. Do you really need to do cold calls? Before coaching you how to do it well, I'd be like, do we really need to do this? Is this really the only thing that's left as an option for you? But assuming that that was the case, there's some truth that forces you to it, you have to ask yourself, you have to make a hard choice. Either you're going to find a way to love it and to make your cold calls the best interruption of somebody's day, make that call packed with value, stand, you know, above anything that anybody could expect and make this really special and make that your benchmark that you're trying to live up to, or find a new business or a new way of doing things. But currently, you're kind of stuck in this hell of struggling. And you're right. You're never going to get anything done or anything accomplished that way. And we can chat about this more later on if you want.
Questions for Heaton.
I'm next anyways.
Oh, good.
We're alternating, if you've noticed.
Cool.
Or we'll talk over each other.
Yeah. So I actually lean more towards like a background in direct sales, but I'm doing more in the marketing and measuring analytics and doing all that stuff. But I find that I struggle with going up the tree, making changes, coming down and leaving it alone. So do you have a strategy around how you stay productive when you're measuring a lot of things? And, you know, what's your kind of like your calendar or plan for making changes and then coming back to them and being productive in that way?
Yeah, use your calendar. Like just literally like this is like the ultimate marketer's hack, right? You're in this really messed up sort of process where you have to go make a bunch of bets and then you have to wait some amount of time to see if they work. That's essentially the problem I think you're describing. Well, if you're an engineer or designer, you write code or you design something and literally in minutes, you know whether it worked. If you're an engineer, you deploy it, you see it. If you're a designer, you can literally see it in front of you. This is what I drew. This is what I coded. It worked. As a marketer, I would say that your addiction is traffic. You can ask the ball guy in front right here. He's addicted to traffic. That's my co-founder. He does all the marketing. And so my advice is calendar it, right? Like it's calendar to the point where it's like create new campaigns on Monday. Look at the campaigns on Wednesday, right? And then go figure out what to do for next week on Friday. Because then you're gonna have to create new campaigns on Monday. So whatever your schedule is, just put a regimen and a schedule. That way you know when to look at it. One of the worst things for me, even still to this day, is setting up and starting an A/B test and then just biting my nails as I watch it happen. So this hack of like getting distracted in the middle of those check-ins has been really useful to me. So maybe you could write code in the middle, right? And then, so like, it's like Monday is marketing day. I create campaigns. Tuesday is engineering day. I'm going to go write some code. Wednesday's marketing day again. I'm going to check how things worked and tweak them, turn them off, whatever. So just set a cadence, set a schedule, and honestly, stick to it. Because marketing's pretty trial and error compared to a lot of other things.
So this is a question for Steli and Hiten at the same time. So
No. Stick to Steli. That's fine. He had his question.
I did.
So this question is more specific. How do you grow when you are operating in a vertical? So I'm in the financial services industry, and we are selling it to financial advisors. We have product that works. People are getting value from it, and you know, how do you grow it from the team of three people to and to 100 customers to 1,000 customers in a specific vertical? So if you can give some tips or advice on that, it'll be awesome.
Well, Hiten, you should answer that.
We have rules, Steli.
And I like to break them just to see that face. She's like, why is he breaking the rule now? All right, so here's my two cents on this. So to summarize the question, you have a bunch of customers in a very specific vertical, and you're like, how do I get more of them? All right. Well, how did you get the first ones?
That's why you wanted me to answer it.
Yeah.
It's my question.
So we started with cold email, reaching out, associations. We recently started with Facebook advertising, which scales a little bit better than just reaching one-to-one to people. But I want to basically attract and generate more leads at scale, right? So I don't want to generate, one or two leads a day, but maybe like 20 a week, for example, right? Things like that.
Yeah, well, I don't know. There's no universal, like, this is the thing you do once you have this, and then that will be the result. Otherwise, why would there be a need for a conference like this, right? We just all follow that one formula. But typically what you do is, it's not so much, so you acquired some customers and you've done it in a very like labor intense, high touch way. And you're like, this is not what I want to do for the rest of my life. And this is not going to allow us to grow as much as our ambition wants us to. So what are the things we haven't done yet that will allow us to get faster, better, more results? And the best way to get there that I know is to spend more time with the customers you've acquired to really get to know them a lot better beyond just getting their money and getting them to buy. You want to figure out where do they spend most of their time? What was the last thing they bought? And are they always buying the way that you sold to them, or what are other ways they are buying? You really want to get to customer insights, because these insights, again, will point you into channels and approaches and ways to grow your company. If you don't spend any of your time once you acquired a customer to get to know them a lot better, then the problem is you're as smart as you were, you know, one customer ago, once you're at 10 customers or 40 customers. So it's we have 50 customers, we used to have one customer, and we still don't know how to get to 10,000 customers. So my advice to you would be spend a lot more time with those customers to learn, ask them that question. Hey, I'm so glad that you bought. This is amazing. One question from a founder to the VP of blah, 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 from basically what you're saying, one important person to another important person. I need advice from you. If you were running my business and if you were running this company and you had the ambition to go from X to Y, how would you do it as an expert in the industry? Just ask them that question more so than any kind of other sales or marketing experts that are more generic, because these people are going to give you the right answers.
And I've got a tip. So Steli has a blog post and probably videos on getting referrals from your customers, especially if you're like high touch, which I think you are. I don't know if it'll get you 20 customers a week, but it's probably a channel that you should use if you're not using it, because apparently his tips work.
Google it.
What advice do you guys have on doing enterprise deals and avoiding getting crushed on price?
What do you mean by crushed on price?
Just caving to excessive discounts and demands.
Oh. Well, Steli's going to tell you not to do that, so don't cave. And he's actually going to tell you the opposite. There's a sticker running around that Scott made that says charge more. Perceived value in enterprise, as the price goes up, the perceived value goes up in enterprise more than other markets. I'm going to defer to Steli in a second, but like in these kind of things that I've seen, they're not looking for a discount. They might not find your product valuable at all if they're the ones pushing you to it. And on your end, the mistake you might make is, I just want to close the deal, so I'll do discounts, or I'll lower the price for some reason and make up a reason why. But like, it's a hack. Like, it's more of a value misalignment that I found, like when you're trying to discount so hard.
Yeah. So when dealing with the enterprise, there's two scenarios. One is they are pushing you on price because they think they can. Mm-hmm. And then you allow them to. In that scenario, just don't. You know, nobody's putting a gun at your hand. You don't have to sell to them. And it's surprising how many times customers have told me, if you don't do X, we will not be able to buy. Mm. And I said, okay, I'm not going to do X. And then they just went and bought anyways. Right? Some salespeople would say buyers are liars. But I think that first of all, a lot of times they don't really know what they will or will not do in the future. They're just humans, right? They're just emotional. And or they're just bad negotiators, and they think the best way to negotiate is to tell you some consequence they think you're afraid of. So you don't have to say yes just because somebody tells you they're not going to buy if you don't do that. The other scenario is, in some cases, depending on who buys your product, sometimes you have to go through procurement at some point or something along those lines. The discount is part of the sales process, because somebody in that buying process, the whole reason they exist is to get a discount. So in those cases, you just price your product in a way that takes that into account. And you just realize, I can't say there's not going to be a discount because there's somebody that's not going to approve this, because this person's job and livelihood depends on saying, I brought us this amount of savings. So they'll just apply this to every situation. If you are that type of enterprise sale, you just increase your product by 40% in price, give yourself a little raise for the hard work that you have to sell one more person or one more stage, and you give them a 30% discount at that stage. But just because they ask you, just because they're big and you're small, doesn't mean you have to do what they tell you to do. There's a reason here's my number one advice when you deal with really large customers. There's a reason why they're at the table with you. And it's not that you're so worthless that it's not worth their time. There's a reason they're talking to you, right? So act like it.
So I'm developing an ERP app for coffee roasters. This is a very small vertical. And I'm just trying to figure out if the value metric hasn't been defined. It's something that they don't have a solution right now. How do we basically figure out how to price when they are using, you know, Excel and everything else?
Are you doing sales, like inside sales to them, like talking to them and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I'm from the industry, and when I sell, I can sell, but it's right now I'm saying, hey, I'll give you a deep discount because I just want to get you on board and I get a couple customers. But then what's next after that when I don't have enough history to define it?
Well, what was the original question again? I'm trying to get the nuance. So,
So if you create a solution that there's not a comparable value metric for, how do you define the price?
So at the end of the day, they're still there. I can't imagine you're in a scenario where they're not doing the thing that you're going to make easier for them to do. So they might not have a solution for it. I mean, this is classic B2B SaaS in my mind, which is equivalent of, oh, they're using Excel today, right? This is like people were using Excel and stuff like that to do project management, and then things like Basecamp came along and all that. So the way you could have this conversation is if you understand what they're doing, I'm getting very detailed, but like this is really useful even internally, even if you don't speak to them like this, but understand what they're doing today, what the costs are, hourly cost by team members, cost of a certain tool, cost time even wasted is a cost, waiting time is a cost, and quantify all the costs. And then you can have some reasonable justification to say something like, and this is the ultimate in a model like this, but it's like you would say like, you know, from all the customers we've talked to that are just like you, this is how much time, effort, money, whatever the metric is, it takes for them to do things currently before they use our tool. Then once they start using our tool, this is the savings we provide, this is how much more money we can make you, blah, blah, blah. So you're almost presenting a scenario of here's where you are with our solution, here's where you're going to get to. You make it up, because like it's software. Software automates, right? Or speeds things up, make it up.
We have time for one more question. Who wants to be last?
Make it a good one. No pressure.
Like really good.
Yeah, fantastic.
There might be room for two. The thing says five.
Oh, he's a good one.
Oh, so I've heard a lot of questions from other attendees at the conference so far about how do you come up with kind of like a comprehensive marketing strategy? It's not like specifics, but you know, knowing what you know of kind of you got to 15 or 20 customers, how do you kind of think about scaling a marketing strategy to get to like 100 or 200 customers? I know you guys have kind of talked around it a little bit, but how do you think about like coming up with a plan? Not really the specifics, but it's for Steli.
God damn you.
I faked him out right there.
This is, by the way, this gentleman makes a podcast go from my Dropbox folder to the magical place of iTunes and then to the people that are listening here. So if you want to do a podcast, this is the man to talk to. Podcast Motor, big shout out. Is the question, how do you go from like 10 to 100, 100 to 1,000, or how do you put together some strategy in your marketing? Because in the early days, you might not have any.
Yeah, do more free work. That's what got him here, I guess. I don't know. For us.
For us, that's how the marketing plan was to give these two people, to help them with their podcast. So one day they go to a conference and then you're in the first row and then you ask them a question and then one of those guys gives you a big shout out.
Yeah, repeat that. Repeat that.
Just keep doing that. Just with everyone. The answer is I don't know. Like I don't know. I think that just like with everything else, as you move forward and you progress, you learn things, you gain insights about what works and what doesn't. You learn more about yourself and your team. Where are we really good at? What can we do exceptionally well versus things that might be great things to do, but we're just not as good at? And based on these learnings, you ask yourself, all right, what is kind of the next step that we can take? And my experience is that in the early days, you want to be hyper-focused on the day. Like you want to be hyper-focused on super short term. You want to violently execute a mediocre plan today. Too many people fail in the early days because they think too far ahead. But then once you get to a significant scale, once you got from like one customer to 10 to 100 to 1,000, once you get to a point where your business makes significant revenue, then you start shifting from something that's like 100% of your effort and energy is just spent on like short term, to starting to spread out more and spending 70% of your time on short term things and spending 30% of your time, a little bit of time midterm and long term. And eventually that ratio changes. And hopefully at some point your business is so successful and so big that you spend almost all your time on really long term things. And I think that's where strategy plays a bigger part, because then you start thinking really about the next 5 years and the big trends and the big initiatives. But I think that people start to worry about that stuff. They tend to worry about this stuff way too early. We got three customers. How can we now put a strategy plan together, hire a VP of marketing? It's like, just chill out, right? I know we all want to get there really fast, but usually people get there too early. We've made the opposite mistake in our business. We went there, we were so good at the executing and the here and now, we're crushing it until the business got so big that that wasn't working anymore, but it was very habitual. So we're now in the process of kind of starting to implement more longer-term thinking, more longer-term strategy, because the business is just way too big for the way we were operating it in the early days. So we made the opposite mistake, but yeah, don't worry about it so much.
So we have time for one more question. We do have a little time we need to go between speakers.
I'm curious what strategies you recommend for identifying pricing tiers for a software as a service app. If you already have a collection of features and you understand the benefit they're providing to a customer, how do you break down what you should be charging? Does it come down to customer interviews, something else?
We're going to walk off stage, and the next person that walks on is going to answer that question. And if he does not, then ask him the question.
Yes. And usually any pricing-related question we get, Heaton is just referring to that person anyways. He's like, I don't have to answer this.
So you can meet the person right now.
There you go.
Thank you very much, for Stelling Heaton.
Thank you.
Wait.
What do we got?
So after the conference this evening, both Stelly and Heaton will be in the next room over right after, where it's probably around 5, somewhere between 5:45 and 6 is when they'll get started. But they're basically going to be doing office hours. So if anyone has any specific direct questions you want to ask of them, if you didn't want to ask them now, you can do that then.
Yeah, and also, if you ask a question and you're like, I'd love to ask 10 follow-up questions and really get super specific and concrete and off record, meet us at the room where lunch was right after this event is over, and we're going to spend an hour there and chit-chat with you. Thanks. Thank you.